Good evening. It is Friday, February 21st, 2020. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. And since it's Friday, we're kicking off today's show with my first guest. He's a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets and author of City Builders and Vandals in Our Age, Caleb Maupin. As always, Caleb, welcome back.
Glad to be here, as always.
So let's start with, you know, a lot of people were waiting with bated breath for Michael Bloomberg to get to the debate stage. And unfortunately for him, so was Senator Elizabeth Warren. He wasn't stop and frisked. He was cavity searched. Is the DNC tone deaf? Are they inept? What's your thoughts on his display and then your take on the debate overall?
Well, I think what came out is that Michael Bloomberg, the creator of Bloomberg Media, one of the big news sources for Wall Street, was part of that Wall Street culture that people who have worked down there and know all about it are very well familiar with, right? The workplace culture of sexual harassment, the crude comments to women, the crassness, the racism, the casual racist comments and such. You know, Bloomberg is a Wall Street guy by definition. I mean, that's where he comes from. And that's not something that the rank and file of the Democratic Party is particularly attracted to. And I think Elizabeth Warren made that pretty clear during the debate, and she threw everything at him but the kitchen sink, so to speak. What was interesting was seeing Bloomberg throw at Bernie Sanders the fact that Bernie Sanders is a millionaire, which then raises the question, how poor should Bernie Sanders be in order to remain a socialist, right? Now, I mean, now say Bernie Sanders only had $900,000, would that be okay? Say Bernie Sanders had $500,000, would that be okay? I mean, he is a U.S. senator, after all, a career politician, an author of a book, but a lot of Americans seem to have it in their mind that socialism is opposition to having any wealth or anyone living comfortably. So the notion that Bernie Sanders, who calls himself a democratic socialist, has wealth is seen to somehow be a piece of proof that he is a hypocrite. Quite an interesting framing of the discussion.
Hang on, Caleb, because to that point, I can answer your question because I studied political economy. In fact, that was going to be my area of specialization. A socialist cannot make more than $70,000. A democratic socialist cannot make more than $83,270 a year. So go ahead.
Very, very good. I mean, it's quite an interesting thing, but it fits into this very widespread belief. You know, for years, the main talking point of those defenders of capitalism is this belief that believers in socialism do want everyone to be poor. They just want everyone to be poor and equal. We hear the stories of Eastern Europe and, you know, people waiting in line for food. And there's this whole conception that socialism is a belief that poverty is beautiful, like Mother Teresa infamously said, or something like that. When actually, if one reads the writings of Karl Marx, the entire aim of socialism is to create a vast material abundance. The ultimate goal is a society with so much material abundance and so much wealth that the need for any coercion or a state can fade away. I mean, Karl Marx was envisioning some kind of high-tech utopia in which there was just so much material abundance and so little work that needed to be done. People could live from each according to their ability and to each according to their need. So, yeah, I socialism and people living well, I think the idea is to eradicate poverty, not to eradicate wealth.
I'm glad you made that point, because then within that, democratic socialism also has differences and variances. So to just describe Bernie Sanders as a socialist is a misrepresentation of his politics.
Indeed, Bernie Sanders doesn't advocate a state-run economy. He advocates a European-style welfare state. I will say, though, that by using the campaign slogan, abolish billionaires, that puts him in a weak position because that immediately opens up to, oh, well, why not abolish millionaires? Oh, because you're one. I get it. Right? That puts him in a weaker spot. I don't think that's a very good choice of a campaign slogan, in my opinion. But I don't think it's going to damage him that much in the long term. If you look at it, he's soaring ahead in the polls right now.
I don't know if you saw Elizabeth Warren last night at this town hall meeting, but I thought her opening was brilliant when she came out and said, I used to teach contract law. And so what I've done is I've written up an agreement for Bloomberg where he'll be able to basically relinquish these folks from their obligations under their non-disclosure agreements. I thought that was brilliant. Oh, and then she said, and I'll text it to him and he can sign it. And then once he signs it, all the people that sign those NDAs can go ahead and talk. I thought that was really clever and very, very well done.
Indeed. Rhetorical brilliance.
In terms of the overall debate, am I too naive to think that the candidates should be talking about the sluggish 2.3 economic growth, the wealth gap, how international exams show that American 15-year-olds are stagnant in reading and math when compared to their international counterparts, foreign policy? To me, the lack of a broader scope of substantive policy discussion was lacking and was incredibly disappointing.
Indeed, but I mean, we can expect as much. I mean, this is American politics where we have a reality TV star president and it's a battle of personalities. You know, we're supposed to think about who's getting along with who. You know, many people voted for Sarah Palin because she thought that she had and her kids was great and that they liked how she was a hockey mom. Many people voted for Barack Obama because he had a very cute dog and two really cute daughters that seemed really nice. And, you know, I mean, this is American politics, unfortunately. And what's the saddest is that the people that are very deeply informed and up on issues tend to be very solidly in one camp or other. And the election tends to be decided by the folks that are basing things on whether or not they like the way someone talks or whether or not they want to have a beer with them. Those are the undecided voters in those battleground states that ultimately end up deciding the election. That kind of thing is probably far, far more important than any political stand a leader could take at the end of the day. That's what makes American politics so strange, where only certain states really matter when it comes down to it with the Electoral College. And then you add on to that only certain undecided voters are really going to swing it one way or another. This is American politics in our age. I think it's kind of amusing that Vladimir Lenin, at one point when he was describing the situation in Russia after the failure of the 1905 revolution, he was describing the situation. He said depression, demoralization, and splits were everywhere, and pornography took the place of politics. And I find that to be an amusing quote because there are many times where I feel like in our current political atmosphere, many times what you could describe as pornography has taken the place of politics.
And to that point, and you mentioned Sarah Palin, and I'm not going to link her to pornography, but I have said for a very long time that I see Sarah Palin as having been the Trojan horse for Donald Trump. And I don't mean intentionally. I believe that she, in the fact that she was so inept, the fact that she was so ill and misinformed and uninformed, and was elevated to the position of being the running mate of John McCain, where people were convinced that she actually was competent enough to be the vice president of the United States, that laid the foundation for a Donald Trump to come along and become president. Am I stretching that too far?
No, you're not. When Sarah Palin was selected as John McCain's running mate, John McCain was a typical neoconservative, but Palin was very much a wink and a nod to the far, far right, or what people might call the ideological right. Let's remember that her husband was not a Republican, but was a registered member of the Alaskan Independence Party, which gives its ballot line to the Constitution Party. She had gotten a lot of approval and support from the Libertarian Party, from some, you know, some far right organizations. And that even though Palin, you know, on TV, she was portrayed as just this kind of, you know, ditzy woman who is a mom and likes to hunt and shoot deer from helicopters or something. You know, I mean, she was also somebody who had a reputation as one of the quote-unquote better politicians among the ideological right wing. You know, you talk about those Montana Freemen. You talk about those ranchers, the Bundy Ranch and all of that. Mm-hmm. You talk about those elements that are out west, right? They're in states that are less populated. I mean, Alaska's way up there. But, you know, I mean, in places like Idaho, places like that, they see the federal government as their enemy. They've got their guns, you know, posse comitatus. And, you know, they want to go back to the Constitution as original intent. And they don't like the federal government. And, you know, there's a conspiracy with the thing high up on the thing that's communist and trying to take away our freedom. And it's like that crowd. Sarah Palin was loved by those folks long before anyone else had ever heard of her.
Let's switch gears now to Roger Stone. Roger Stone Jr., the Republican political consultant, he was sentenced yesterday to 40 months in prison for lying to Congress and obstructing the Russia investigation. Judge Amy Berman Jackson, Federal District Court of D.C., she handed down the sentence. I think it's important to note that Stone's case shares the very same fundamental prosecutorial assumptions that are underpinning the Julian Assange extradition issue, namely that Assange and WikiLeaks are hostile foreign actors and not members of the Fourth Estate. Your thoughts on Roger Stone's sentencing?
What I find to be interesting is, will Trump pardon him or not? I feel like everything we know about Donald Trump, everything we know about politics and the way it works, everything we know about Roger Stone's career would point to Donald Trump pardoning Roger Stone. But I don't see Trump rushing to do that. There was the whole thing with William Barr and the sentence guidelines and that whole thing. But at the same time, you know, I don't see Donald Trump rushing to pardon him. Now, maybe he's waiting to do it at a time that he would get less bad press for it. A lot of times things like that in Washington, D.C. are done on a Friday right before a holiday weekend where they're hoping it won't get a big media round. But I find it interesting. You know, Paul Manafort has not been pardoned. He remains, you know, convicted. And it is interesting. You have to wonder, who does Trump pardon? Who does he not pardon? Blagojevich has been released. Now, what was that about? Blagojevich was a Democrat in Chicago, right? An Illinois Democrat. However, I think many people have speculated that the pardon of Blagojevich or the commuting of his sentence or whatnot is related to the fact that Blagojevich was an enemy of Barack Obama somehow, right? That Blagojevich went down just after Obama took office. He was part of Illinois, Chicago politics and was somebody who was in a faction that was against Obama, and that perhaps Blagojevich was released simply as a diss to Barack Obama. It was very strangely timed. And why after all this time? So there's a lot of things about Trump's pardons that are very, very strange, right? We recall that despite the fact that he was overwhelmingly guilty of campaign fraud and other malfeasance, Dinesh D'Souza, the conservative commentator, was pardoned by U.S. President Donald Trump long after his sentence had been completed. That was clearly a political gesture. And Trump is using these pardons to make political statements. But they're odd political statements. They're statements that mean something to somebody, but don't necessarily communicate a very clear message to the general public. So will the Roger Stone pardon come down? I suspect it will, but I wonder when.
And the when, I think, is very important because Blagojevich served time. Blagojevich spent, 4 or 5 years in prison. And he had, I don't know, another 3 or 4 years left on his sentence. So because he served time, I don't know that there are a lot of people screaming and yelling about, oh, he should never have been released because he served time. He didn't kill anybody. You know, okay. I wonder if Roger Stone will wind up playing the Frank Pantangeli role from The Godfather, where Tom Hayden went to him while he was in prison and said, hey, Frank, you know what the Romans used to do? You might want to have to take this one for the team. Now, I don't know that Stone would do this willingly, but it just would not surprise me if the president has Stone sit in prison at least till after the election. And then if he is reelected, make a move. If he's not reelected, he still has time before the 21st of January when the new president is sworn in. But it would not surprise me if Roger Stone is going to have to spend a couple days in prison.
Indeed, indeed. And it also raises the question, as, you know, the prosecution did seem to invoke allegations about Assange with the continued situation of extraditing Assange. If Roger Stone is remaining in prison, he could then be compelled to testify against Assange, right? I mean, a prisoner would just be transported right to the testimonial facility. I guess he could refuse to say anything and get contempt of court, but it would be very hard to not make him stand, you know, show up for a court proceeding against Assange.
That would be interesting, because really what Roger Stone has been convicted of is a bunch of nothing. The whole Russiagate investigation has proved to be a big fat nothing. So this, as Patrick Hennigan said yesterday on Fault Lines, he got convicted of what is akin to convicting someone for trying to cover up the existence of Sasquatch. So Roger Stone got convicted he lied about something that wound up actually not existing. And to the point about Assange, so Stone is charged with lying to the Intelligence Committee about communicating with the Trump campaign about imminent WikiLeaks releases, but Julian Assange had already said, I'm going to announce publicly. He said this on multiple occasions, you know, in the summer of 2016. He said this in the United States. He said it in Britain. So what Roger Stone wound up alleging to have access to was already made public by Assange himself. So rolling Stone into court to talk about Assange, I don't really know what the government gets out of that, unless it's just the optics of it and then their ability to continue to spin it.
I feel like there is an agreement, what you might call like an unspoken agreement or a gentleman's agreement among people at the top, that, you know, we're all friends after six, we run against each other, we do attack ads on each other, mm-hmm. but there are certain things we don't do, right? There are certain lines we don't cross. And I get the impression that at some point during the 2016 campaign, it is perceived by the Democrats and even by some Republicans that Trump crossed some lines that it is widely understood mm-hmm. you don't cross. Mm-hmm. And this is an attempt to control Trump and keep him from crossing some of those lines. We don't know exactly what those lines are. The media is full of hysterical allegations that don't seem to always add up. But it seems to me there's a feeling that in order to get into the White House, Trump broke some of the unwritten rules of Washington politics, and they don't want him doing that. And they don't want the door to be open for other people to do that now that Trump has done it and found his way into the presidency.
The one thing we do seem to understand about Donald Trump is friendships aren't valued to the degree that most people value them, which is why it would not surprise me if Stone does not get a pardon, because Roger Stone may very well now come to understand the value of his friendship with the president.
Indeed, indeed. And I'm sure the Trump internet will be full of explanations about what's really going on, you know, QAnon, and there's all kinds of theories. You talk to Trump people, you know, you watch Fox News, you think that that's what the Trump movement believes. But talk to an average Trumper at a rally. The Trump movement is full of very, very different takes and theories about what's actually going on in Washington. There are many different constituencies who have many different theories about what motivates the president's actions. It's very interesting that Trump has this ability to tell so many people, not directly, I'm with you and I'm against the other ones. It's very strange. So much of the Trump camp is very, very specific factions related to, you know, Cuba or related to Israel or related to, you know, wars or related to the military or related to this or that. And they all believe Trump is with them and he's just playing the other ones. It's kind of a strange psychology. Trump has the ability to get up and send kind of winks and nods and signals to all kinds of different people so that they believe he's with them and not the others. Very strange.
I base my point on looking at Michael Cohen, who is still languishing in prison. At one point, he saw Donald Trump as a father figure. To your earlier point, Paul Manafort is still languishing in prison. And so those types of relationships, or what many people thought were very tight, close relationships, they weren't close enough to get them out of prison. Final point for you, Julian Assange. Australian MPs are calling upon the United Kingdom to block U.S. extradition. I find it interesting that Australia is now very publicly and through members of their government stepping to the forefront and protecting Julian Assange. Your thoughts on these latest developments?
Well, if you're going to enforce international law fairly, there's a very strong argument that extraditing Julian Assange to the United States would be a violation of international law. We know what goes on in U.S. prisons. We know about torture, Guantanamo Bay. We know that at this point, we have lawyers saying that what he's endured in the United Kingdom is tantamount to torture, and that if you were to hand Julian Assange over to the U.S. government, there is a very, very big probability that what he would endure at the hands of the U.S. government would be, you know, the equivalent of torture, and that would be something that a government would have the right to essentially violate their extradition treaty with the United States and say, look, you know, because we believe you will violate this person's human rights, you will carry out activities that violate the UN Charter, because of that, we are not going to hand him over to you. And I think a strong argument for that can be made. And Australia, you know, I mean, Assange being Australian, I mean, they are doing what you would expect a country to do under such circumstances, right? I mean, if some government is likely to torture somebody and they're being on the verge, and their citizen is being on the verge of handed over to them, you would expect a government to step up and take responsibility. The question is, will it actually happen? Will they hand him over? And why has it taken so long? That's what I'm perplexed by. I have a feeling that this could have moved a lot faster if there weren't some disagreements and if there weren't, you know, there weren't some very, very different agendas here and some very, very, very unclear ideas about that. The same with the extradition case of the Huawei, chief financial officer in Canada. Mm-hmm. This is very strange. Often people are extradited very instantaneously. They're apprehended in Canada and they're back in the USA a couple days later. It doesn't normally take years and years for extradition cases to go on like this. This shows that there are questions here and there's not clear unity.
As always, Caleb Maupin, thank you so much for your time. Greatly, greatly appreciate your invaluable analysis and look forward to having you back.
Sure. It's always a pleasure for me.
Thanks, man. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, it's Friday, so that means it's panel time, so let's get right to it. We have a political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist. His latest piece can be found at Counterpunch and The Polemicist, entitled Impeachment, What Lies Beneath. He is Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Leon.
We're joined by a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar, as always. Daniel Lazar, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And we've got a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California. He's the author of the new book and great book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's start with Jim Kavanaugh. Your thoughts on Wednesday's Democratic debate?
Rock'em sock'em Dems. Yeah, it was a heck of a performance, I got to say. You know, sure, everybody knows that Elizabeth Warren did a hell of a job knocking down Bloomberg. Really, just fabulous. Good for her. You know, and Bloomberg just demonstrated that he's an arrogant, entitled ass who is not used to being challenged in this way. You know, he was just obviously kind of incredulous that anybody would be actually attacking him and asking him questions and going over his record like that. So you saw what you have with him, who he's a boss. He's not running for president. He considers himself a boss and he wants to be treated like a boss, and he wasn't. And so he was taken down a peg. You know, I think Bernie did very well. He held his own. That's all he had to do. He slapped back the attacks that came at him. And I think, generally speaking, you know, the person who was helped the most, obviously, by that performance was Elizabeth Warren. Now I have my whole theory about what we're watching unfold here.
And we'll get to that. We'll get to that in a second. That's going to be a second. So hold off on that for a second.
I'm going to, but I'm just saying. So I think really, I think Buttigieg and Klobuchar had their little food fight amongst themselves and didn't help either of them. So I think really we got Bernie still as the front runner. Elizabeth Warren has helped herself, and I think it's going to help her in the elections, probably. I'm not sure. But Bloomberg's going to have to spend a lot more money to recover from this, and he will. He's going to continue spending the money, and I wouldn't rule him out because of this, because he's just got so much money to spend.
Daniel Lazar, your thoughts?
I basically agree. I would quibble with a few of those judgments. I mean, I don't think Warren did as well as that. She was very good in knocking down Bloomberg, but she has a way of rattling on when it comes to various proposals. I want to do this, I want to do that. That winds up kind of being seeming shallow and inconsistent. And Sanders, on the contrary, sort of like slams home a few, compelling facts and figures. And the line about Bloomberg having greater wealth than the bottom 125 million Americans was, that was a real zinger. That was really good. That was very clear. And I think that really resonated with viewers. And I think that Bloomberg was really hit bad. In fact, I think he was really just kind of demolished. Yeah, maybe he'll keep spending money, but as far as I'm concerned, he's following Joe Biden, down the toilet.
Dr. Jack Rasmus.
Well, obviously Warren was at the center of everything there quite a bit. And what it means that she's going to escalate that strategy or that tactic again. And I think others are going to jump on that tactic. And if you think this debate was hot, wait till the ones coming up. There's going to be a real firefight going on, which is great. As far as Bloomberg, Bloomberg... NDA, right? Trump retread on NDA on women. Boy, does he have a bag that he's going to have to carry into every debate. That's going to be brought up again and again and again. And, Bloomberg is going to spend even more money to try to offset it. That's for sure. And he's just not, he's the boy of the money bag wing of the Democratic Party. They're setting him up for a contested convention, and they're going to throw those 500 special delegates behind them. You can even see them already being lined up, mayors across the country, who are part of the 500 delegates. And, the party hacks are being lined up to support him on a split vote that'll come on the first ballot. Biden, last hurrah. I agree. Buttigieg, Klobuchar food fight. No one won there. And Sanders, no one went after him except the stupid claim charge about he's a communist, by Bloomberg, But I just want to say there's a strategic thing here that we're seeing. And that is, I think, the beginning of a real problem for the Democratic Party. Who are really in the lead? Two outliers who have total, new program. Here's Sanders. He's, on the very left, maybe not even a Democrat. And here's Bloomberg, who's a Republican, posturing as a Democrat. And they're the leaders. And the rest of them in the middle, to some extent, maybe, Warren the chameleon, you don't know where she stands. But the rest of them in the middle, representing traditional Democratic Party positions, people don't want that anymore. That's fading away. Maybe the over 60 crowd will still vote for that. But, the new life in the party and versus the money in the party, that's what's this fight's all about. And it's going to get more intense and clearer as we go. And if the Democrats scuttle Sanders at the convention, which I think is more than 2-1 chance, they're going to lose the youth vote. They're going to lose the election.
And Jack, that takes me to the next point and to what Jim was getting ready to get into in terms of what are we really watching here? And let me just make a couple quick points. One is Bloomberg, I thought, was a disappointment on every level. It would have been one thing to me if he just gave a poor debate performance because he hasn't been on that stage yet. It's been a long time since he's had to face that type of incoming pressure. So if maybe he had been able to make his points but just was inartful, okay, I'll give you a pass. But he was just totally, I saw absolutely nothing of value. I even had to ask myself at one point the question I think he was asking himself, what the hell am I doing here? I mean, it just seemed to be he thought he was going to Macy's and wound up on the stage of a Democratic debate. And to the other point about his poor performance and his ability to spend money, does that matter when, to Jack's point, he, I believe, was sent there by the party elite? He is who they believe will be their salvation in terms of this election. And I see them willing to lose with Bloomberg than possibly win with Bernie. And so to that, Jim Kavanaugh, you can now go where you wanted to go with this. What are we actually watching here? Because I think this Bloomberg move was the setup from the very beginning.
Well, yeah, what we're watching is exactly what we saw. Namely, Bloomberg is coming in, and he's obviously a terrible candidate. He cannot be given the nomination, and he cannot win the general election. And everybody knows it. What you saw was Elizabeth Warren pivoting back to the left and being a hard ass against Bloomberg, right? And the Democratic Party has to do two things to survive. They have to get rid of Bernie, knock off Bernie Sanders and steal the nomination from him, even if he comes in the plurality. And they have to do it in a way that's not going, that they can imagine won't destroy the party and drive everybody away. And the way that's going to be is on the second round, and you're watching this happen, give it to Elizabeth Warren because she's the progressive other anti-billionaire candidate. And they'll be able to say, oh, you see, we gave it to the anti-billionaire candidate, the other anti-billionaire candidate who's not a communist. And you're going to watch this. I'm predicting this is what we're watching happening right now. Elizabeth Warren is getting her super PAC. She's going to get the money that she needs. Okay? They're setting up Elizabeth Warren to be the candidate that defeats that is neither Bernie Sanders, the villainous billionaire, sexist, racist Republican, nor Bernie Sanders, the Democrat. Neither Blanca Bloomberg, the villainous racist Republican, nor Bernie Sanders, the communist. But she's a real progressive anti-watcher. She's going to be tough, and she's going to give the tough anti-billionaire line that she's. But she'll have her super PAC behind her. Where's that money going to come from? You know, so I think that's what we're seeing set up here, because that's the only other person. As everybody said, nobody else has any credibility at all in this. That's the only other person the Democrats could give the nomination to, stealing it from Bernie, and hope that a large portion of Bernie Sanders supporters and Bernie himself will support. Because Bernie is pledging to support everybody, and unfortunately, he may even say, okay, I'll support Bloomberg, but he's not going to go out and campaign for it. He'll go out and campaign for it.
Okay. Daniel, your thoughts on this, and let me ask this question before you answer. The final question of the night had to do with procedure and had to do with should there be a second ballot? What do you do with the superdelegates? And should the one with the most votes going in, even if that candidate does not meet the threshold, should they be granted the nomination? Everybody on the panel, except for Bernie, said no, you need to go through the process. The rules are the rules. That made me wonder, did everybody get a memo that Bernie didn't get? Was everybody invited to a meeting that Bernie didn't get an invitation to? Or is he just ignoring what the rest of them seem to be the foregone conclusion? Because Bernie said, no, the one with the most votes should get the nod. You shouldn't have to go through this superdelegate process and blah, 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 blah. And especially those saying we should follow the rules when they changed the rules to let Bloomberg on the stage in the first place. That argument to me made absolutely no sense. Daniel Lazar.
Well, I agree that question seems to hint at some kind of concerted effort by the other candidates to block, you know, to block Sanders at the last minute. It seems to suggest that possibility. So, and it seems to suggest that the party apparatus is gearing for a last-ditch stop Bernie movement. But I just want to emphasize one thing. I mean, everyone here on this, you know, talking now seems to assume that there's some kind of force in control, and underestimating the degree to which this is just an organic process which is unfolding with no one controlling it and no one certain how it's going to turn out, and people watching either with glee or with horror how this whole thing is breaking.
Okay, Let me stop you there, if I could, and just say this. I'm not a grand conspiracy theorist, and even though none of y'all can see me, I do not have my tinfoil hat on with the coat hanger sticking out. I left that at my desk. But this is why I think it's a setup. We thought a year and a half ago that Keith Ellison was going to be the chair of the DNC. Barack Obama stepped in and said no. He's not, because and there was this consensus, I guess, within the leadership. We can't have a Muslim as the head of the DNC. And so that's how Perez got the nod. Bloomberg didn't meet the rules to get up on the debate stage until the DNC changed the rules to allow Bloomberg on the debate stage. And so I just see this. Now here, Jack Rasmus, here's my economics coming. The invisible hand is not only controlling the economy, it seems to be controlling the DNC. So what I see, and Daniel, I'll let you finish, what I see is the DLC controlling the DNC. I don't think it's the fact that they're just totally inept and that this thing is just wandering down the road aimlessly. I think the Clintons and I think Barack Obama is running this show.
Yes, maybe so. But I mean, Clinton is a spent force. I mean, every time she opens her mouth, the whole party jumps down her and tells her to be quiet. And Obama has stayed out of the race because I think he's afraid of suffering the same fate as Hillary. And if Sanders is far and away the strongest candidate at this point, if he keeps on if he keeps on gaining momentum, the Democratic leadership knows that if they try to deny him the nomination at the last moment, they will suffer the wrath of his very passionate following. And that wrath could wind up just destroying the Democratic Party for a generation. So they are really caught between the rock and the hard place. I mean, I agree with everything you're saying, but I just wouldn't overestimate their power. They really are not in control. They're watching things unfold. They're trying to figure out what to do, but they're at a loss.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, to what Daniel just said, I think the leadership of the DNC, they rather see a race war than a class war, and that the money interests that are funding the elite on the DNC side, I don't think they care in terms of, again, they rather lose with Bloomberg and protect their exalted status than win with Bernie and have to actually try to implement some level of substantive change to the systemic process in this country.
Well, it's both a strategy and a plan by the DLC, money bags, and an organic process. It's not that it's either or.
Okay.
We see both of these things happening right before us. They don't have total control, but they got a plan, and they're pushing that plan, and the plan is to keep as many candidates in the race and fund them in order to split the primary votes. I mean, look, how many of the billionaire hedge fund guys who are putting a lot of money behind Buttigieg really thinks he's going to win the nomination? No. And as far as a Warren is concerned, it's quite possible you would see a Bloomberg Warren ticket. That's their way of keeping the left flank engaged. Look, and you know, Bloomberg's a terrible candidate, but I could see a lot of them just talking about, well, you know, we only lost by 70 electoral votes in three swing states, and Trump has really screwed it up and everything. You know, we don't really need that much to win, you know, is what they're probably saying. And so a Bloomberg Warren ticket would be, a winner for them as far as they're concerned. As far as Bloomberg, you got to remember, how many tens of millions did he give the Democratic Party, DLC, leadership in order to change the rules to get him in? They changed the rules. And, boy, he even mentioned it. He even mentioned that he had contributed to the Democratic Party. I think it's, you know, upward to $50 million. I'm not sure, but I'd like to know how much that is. And as far as Obama not supporting anyone, have you watched the TV ads? It's all Obama, Bloomberg, Obama, Bloomberg. And watch Obama come out in the next, before the Super Tuesday or right after, really attacking Sanders. That's being planned. They probably already got the ads already made. So, you know, I mean, you got to look at the whole picture. It's a process, true. But I really believe there is a plan. There is a strategy. And to an extent, I think you're probably right, Wilmer. You know, remember the 1972 election with McGovern? Mm-hmm. And the entire Democratic leadership came out against McGovern for Richard Nixon. And yes, they're quite capable of doing that. But I think they'll probably go with a Bloomberg Warren.
I hadn't planned to bring up the ad issue, but since Jack did it, let's see if we can get through this one really quickly. I posted on Facebook yesterday that you have African-Americans like Jeffrey Canada from New York and Michael Nutter, the former mayor of Philadelphia. And I said, Barack Obama backing Bloomberg. And I said, how can those in black leadership positions be trying to sell us this crazy foolishness called Bloomberg? And there were those on Facebook that tried to pillory me, saying, how can you say that Barack Obama is endorsing Bloomberg? I said, the endorsement is a tacit endorsement. Look at all of these ads. And then I had people telling me, well, you just don't understand that Michael Bloomberg can use the president's image. He doesn't have to get permission. I said, it's not a matter. I'm not making this a legal argument. I'm saying that there's no way in the world that a Michael Bloomberg is going to have not only all of those photographs of Obama, but have his voice as well on these ads without Barack Obama saying, okay. Otherwise, he's going to get a phone call saying, look, man, you might want to cease and desist doing this. And I had people telling me that I was absolutely out of my mind. Jim Kavanaugh, your thoughts, and then just on that point, and we'll move on. And then we'll go to the other two.
Sure. When Ronald Reagan used Bruce Springsteen's music, he said, I don't want you using my music. Barack Obama could do that if you want. I don't want you using my face and voice. But I'll tell you again, Barack Obama is not going to endorse Michael Bloomberg explicitly. He will endorse Elizabeth Warren explicitly. It's not going to be a Bloomberg-Warren ticket. Bloomberg's going to give his delegates to Warren if he has to be in order to preserve the credibility of the two-party system. It'll disappear, as Daniel says, and everybody knows, if they give this to Bloomberg. The Democrats' credibility will be gone forever. The only way they can hope to hold on any of the quote-unquote progressive supporters of Bernie Sanders is if they give it to Warren. And then if she loses to Trump, it's going to be again, oh, she lost because she was a woman and the whole country is sexist, just like they lost because the whole country was racist. They can't play that game if you get Bloomberg versus Trump, and they know it.
And Daniel, they'll also say, to Jim's point, she tried to take the party too far to the left. And you see, those left-leaning politics just don't work.
Yes, they will say that, certainly. I think the Democratic, the apparatus, the party apparatus, is losing power. And their options are running out. I think one reason Obama has not said anything regarding Bloomberg's use of his image is that he's afraid. He doesn't want to get involved in a brawl.
I never looked at it that way.
He's afraid of getting involved in a brawl. He wants to stay aloof. Obama's a very cautious, very cagey guy, never more so than at this moment. And he wants to hold himself aloof before finally stepping in at some moment to endorse a candidate he finds congenial.
Real quick, Daniel, I have never said that Obama would make that a public fight, but I just think that somebody on behalf of Obama would have called Bloomberg and said, no, stop it. You know, don't make us go there.
Yes, perhaps you're right. You know, I mean, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know. Perhaps you're right.
They told me you did.
Perhaps, yes, but perhaps, you know, perhaps Obama is just holding back and saying, like, you know, I'm not going to go there yet. I'm going to, you know, going to keep my powder dry until the right moment. And yes, I agree that, you know, that Elizabeth Warren would be his dream candidate at this point. I mean, he would love to swoop down and endorse, you know, Obama.
Okay.
He'd love to swoop down and endorse Elizabeth Warren at some appropriate moment. I agree he'd be appalled by Sanders' victory, and I don't know quite how he would respond to Bloomberg, would probably make his peace.
So with that, Daniel, and then Jack, I am coming to you. With that, Daniel, are you saying that Obama wants to sit back and then appear to be the kingmaker?
Yes.
Okay.
He wants that, but that presumes there's the appropriate king.
Or queen,
right.
Okay. Okay, Jack Rasmus.
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren is the female Obama. By that I mean she's going to talk the talk during the campaign, and should she get any nomination, you will see her move to the right, just like Obama did after he got the nomination, and appeal to all the money and interest in that party. She's already doing it. As far as Obama, come on. Obama has already come out against Sanders, and he's going to escalate that. You can see who he's really supporting when he gives his okay to Bloomberg to put him one-on-one, in the ads. Bloomberg would not have done that without Obama's okay, and you're going to see more and more of that. And I just don't see Warren getting the nomination. It will be Bloomberg Warren, not Warren Bloomberg or Warren somebody else. I don't believe that they'll do that to save the party. I think they're more inclined to believe that, look, it's going to be a close election. And, people hate Trump and it's only 70 electoral votes in three states. We can swing that again. They're going to go with Bloomberg.
I hadn't planned to ask this question, but now I will, because I think you three can really provide some clarity to this. One of the points that very subtle points that Elizabeth Warren made during the debate on Wednesday in response to Joe Biden saying that she really hadn't run anything, she said, oh, what about the Consumer Fraud Protection, Fraud Protection Bureau? And that kind of just went into the ether sphere. Jim Kavanaugh, let me ask you, was that bureau as consumer friendly as she's making it out to be? There are some that said that was really just the Trojan horse to let the Dodd-Frank move come in, which actually made the banking industry more powerful than before.
Yeah, I don't remember the specifics of that. I know it was not as strong as she presented it to be.
Okay.
And that's not a kind of experience that's really going to be something which is presidential anyway. That would go off in the ether because, you know, she made good efforts at that, at least rhetorically. But again, the whole thing that was set up with Barney Frank and the Democrats and she was just really kind of ultimately toothless against the banks. And, you know, she talks a good game on that. And she has some, I think, sincere feelings about that and anti-corruption feelings. But that has never been translated into something which is seriously, you know, Jack can speak to that probably better than I can, seriously restricted the fraudulence of the banking industry and the credit industry.
And it was Jack's point about her rhetorical efforts like Obama that made me think about that. Daniel Lazar, your thoughts. You know, she touts her creating the legislation and running, I think she ran that bureau, as a positive. But again, there are those that say, no, all that really did was allow Dodd-Frank in and made the banks even stronger.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm very skeptical myself, obviously. I mean, and I've always thought that there was something that Warren was a grandstander. I mean, it's very easy to denounce the banks. I mean, this is an old American tradition.
Jack, your thoughts on my question. Is that a reasonable question to ask about Elizabeth Warren and the Consumer Protection Financial Board?
Yeah, the Consumer Protection Bureau here.
Yes. Yeah.
It did achieve some reasonable gains for consumers, and that's why they went at it immediately and drove her out. The Dodd-Frank bill was passed in 2010, but it was passed with the proviso it would not take effect for 5 years. So they gave 5 years to the lobbyists to go after an already weak bill, and of course they chopped it all up, and what was left of it, after 2015 was pretty much, thrown in the trash can. It hardly exists anymore. But, there were some gains, but it's kind of an esoteric thing, and you won't hear much about it. And she was driven out, no doubt about it.
Okay. So last week we discussed the New York Times. They had a piece entitled Playing on Kansas City Radio, Russian Propaganda. Then we discussed The Hill. Democrats criticize FCC for not taking action against D.C. station, being this one, broadcasting Russian disinformation. Now, today, the Washington Post jumps into the fray. Senior intelligence official told lawmakers that Russia wants to see Trump reelected. Let me start with Jim Kavanaugh. Man, they really just don't want to seem to let this thing go. And that article is very interesting to me because there's nothing in it.
Yeah, really, it's all speculation and supposition, and we think they're going to do this and they're going to do that. And it all comes down to now, they're not really going to directly do it. What they're going to do is put out ideas that then will be repeated by Americans. So you see, what we're doing here is repeating Russian propaganda because they're giving a platform for Americans who have dissatisfactions with the country to state those dissatisfactions and to state their critiques of American politics. And therefore, that's Russian propaganda. And, this is horrible. And it's because there's no other platform where you can do it. So people who have relatively non-mainstream, outside the centrist discourse, critiques of American propaganda and American capitalism and American society have to go to the platforms they're given, and they're given this. And so that becomes Russian propaganda that can be dismissed as the outset. And we have to try and control that, you see. There should be congressmen, congresspeople are going to, we have to control these outlets. We have to silence them. And they do this in a thousand ways, the fact checkers on Facebook and da-da-da-da-da and all of this stuff. So this is what this is about. It's about preparing to discredit any quote-unquote divisive discourse about the United States. And it's going to work against Sanders. And unfortunately, he's repeated some of this stuff himself about Russian interference and this and that and the other thing. But it's just, you think that Vladimir Putin is going around saying, who should we support for American president? I mean, come on. Should we support Bloomberg or Trump? I mean, this is just silly. And they're going to say he wants to support Sanders.
Jack, the opening statement of the article is, a senior U.S. intelligence official told lawmakers last week that Russia wants to see President Trump reelected, viewing his administration as more favorable to the Kremlin's interests, according to people who were briefed on the comments. Now, I'm sure that every government has a preference as to who they'd prefer to deal with or who they'd prefer not to deal with. But to me, in and of itself, that isn't news. And again, this is more unnamed sources, a lot of vague inference, and no tangible fact, which to me, if you look at the definition of propaganda, that's exactly what this Washington Post article is.
Yeah, well, there's no there. It's all speculation, clearly. And, so why are they doing it? Well, they want to keep that issue and that pot boiling here during the election so they can keep raising that issue. And it's also a cover, I believe, if they lose the election, they can blame Russia again, right? That's a possibility. And, if the Democrats get in with the DLC candidate, like Bloomberg or something, you're going to see a real intensification of the tension with Russia, particularly in terms of arming and upping the number of U.S. troops in East Europe and the Baltics and so forth. The U.S. is clearly on a track here. It's been suspended a little bit to try to provoke Russia. And you're going to see that occur. And, of course, this just adds more more fake evidence to that claim. So there's a number of reasons why tactically they keep that pot boiling. Part of it's electoral, part of it's their policy. You know, part of it is, you know, who knows, maybe they can throw. Well, I think another thing is they want to provoke Trump into purging the, you know, the bureaucracy a little bit more. And that becomes an issue for him, too.
Jim Kavanaugh, I wish the Washington Post and the Hill and the New York Times spent as much, if not more, attention on the voting purge in Wisconsin, the voter purge in Georgia, than they're spending on this foolishness. Because if I have to put things on a list in terms of relevance and importance to outcome of the election, purging registered legitimate voters from the rolls has a lot more impact on the election, especially since the Republicans understand there are more registered Democrats than there are Republicans. So their whole game is to remove legitimate voters from the rolls. That's how they level the playing field. But the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Hill, they don't seem to care about that conversation. Jim Kavanaugh.
Well, I fault everybody for this. You know, for 4 years, this is what we should have been talking about. It's clear that we have an electoral system that is massively problematic, and it's not totally corrupt. And there's 100 ways. There's voter suppression. There's purging from the rolls. There's all the things we're seeing now in the Democratic primaries. And you're going to see what some of the similar things to what happened in Iowa happening in Nevada now. And, you know, you have the electronic voting machines. These are all the things which affect voting in America and which do change the outcome in a serious way of votes. And we've had 4 years to talk about this. And I'll say even the left doesn't want to talk about it. They want to talk about the big issues, you know, which is fine. We should talk about the big issues, but you're not going to get anywhere if you can't vote and have a voting system, an electoral system that's transparent, that allows people to vote easily and allows them to have a certainty that their vote's being counted for whom it's cast. And we don't have that in this country, let alone the Electoral College, another story. But, you know, even without a constitutional amendment, we should have spent 4 years making sure these voting systems got right. And we haven't. And now all of a sudden in the middle of the election, oh, look at the problems. Too late.
It's too late. And they don't want to talk about the fact that when you look at particularly, and I keep promoting this, folks, you got to go to Greg Palast, gregpalast.com, and look at his data, because Greg will show you Trump did not win Arizona. Trump did not win Michigan. Trump did not win Ohio. Trump did not win North Carolina. He did not win Florida. If you look at the number of people stricken from the rolls and then look at the number of votes he won those states by, and you extrapolate forward and assign those stricken voters as voters to where they most likely would have gone, the numbers don't lie. Dr. Jack Rasmus, got to thank you. Daniel Lazar, got to thank you. Jim Kavanaugh, got to thank you as always. Really, really appreciate your all's contribution to the Critical Hour.
All right. All right.
Thank you.
All right, fellas. All right, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.